In the last minute we have, I want to ask you about this latest story in Lebanon, where you are. The two separate fires that tore through Syrian refugee camps, killing a small child, injuring scores of people. Can you tell us what's happening there? Then we'll continue in a post-show discussion.
Well, there's over a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon that have come in over the last 6 years. Most of them are scattered in haphazard local communities that have been set up on official camps. A lot of them are getting support from international agencies, and the government is helping out by opening schools and doing other things. But it's quite a chaotic situation in the sense that there's nobody really in charge of their well-being, and they don't have many options to go back to Syria or to stay here permanently. Many of them can't work. Many work illegally. They're mostly poor, and the conditions are very haphazard, and therefore fires. We just had a very strong 10 days of intense heat, and therefore if these fires break out, and you have the
Rami, we have to leave it there, but we're going to continue and post it online at democracynow.org. Rami Khoury, professor of journalism at American University in Beirut. Thanks for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick up paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 9th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
It is 5:02, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland has made $350,000 in grants available to community groups to track local hate crimes, support victims, and train people to resist or disrupt hateful activity.
U.S. police have shot and killed 492 people in the first 6 months of the year, about the same number as in the same period during the last 2 years.
An Afghani robot will be competing in Washington, D.C.'s first global challenge later this month, but the six girls who created it won't be there because some were denied visas.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 5th, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Nursing a fireworks hangover, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael needs a double shot from a 5th of July.
If, as Janis Joplin sang, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, I'm so extremely free, I'm amazed my body parts don't go all their separate ways. Lost my planet, my country, my hope. Maybe the problem with America is independence, disconnected, needing no one, in denial, not my fault or job, celebrating independence with loud booms, noxious smoke, and terrified dogs. Oppression never goes away. It seems part of human nature. Maybe the need for violence against another person, animal, plant is what got us thrown out of paradise. We should celebrate dependence, connection, looking out for and learning from each other. Every interaction can be a community. Every day can be a celebration. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
25-year-old Holden Austin Gurka, a Washington resident who tried to steal a helicopter at gunpoint near the Hillsborough Airport, was shot to death by police on Monday morning. The man threatened a flight instructor at the Hillsborough Air Academy with a gun around 11:40 a.m. on Monday and reportedly fired at least one round, though without injury. The instructor and student fled, and the armed man entered the helicopter and then jumped a fence and ran into a nearby inn where he was apparently cornered by police. An airport security officer first heard of the incident via CNN. Around 12:45 on Monday, flights at the airport were frozen pending the results of the incident.
The City of Portland has made $350,000 in grants available to community groups to track local hate crimes, support victims, and train people to resist or disrupt hateful activity. The grants will be administered through the Neighborhood Office's Portland United Against Hate Coalition. City Commissioner Chloe Udaly, who manages the agency, said, "We are initiating this grant process to get the resources that the City Council unanimously supported deployed as quickly as possible to address the urgent need for action." Udaly's office has reached out to Muslim groups and the LGBTQ community in order to maximize input from frequently targeted groups. Grant applications can demonstrate how they will increase outreach to victims and make it easier to report hate crimes, provide training on how to be an ally and disrupt prejudice and hate activity, or propose tracking and analysis of hate acts to inform policy decisions and broaden community awareness. August 15th is the deadline for applications.
For most politicians, the 4th of July holiday is a traditional time to get out and glad hand the public while marching in Independence Day parades, both large and small. But with angry public responses to both the House and Senate versions of the American Health Care Act, it appears that many Republicans decided that spending a quiet day at home with the family was the smart move. Only 4 of 52 Republican senators decided to participate in any 4th of July parades. Those senators, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Dean Heller of Nevada, and Ted Cruz of Texas, had already said they planned to vote no on the current version of the bill. And since the publicity is overwhelmingly opposed to the AHCA, it was safe for those 4 to show their faces in public. Senator Susan Collins marched in the same Eastport, Maine parade that she has been in for the last 15 years. She waved to the crowd, who applauded and cheered her, and then asked her to not vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare. In a New York Times interview after the parade, Collins said, quote, "I heard over and over again encouragement for my stand against the current version of the Senate and House health care bills. People were thanking me over and over again." Unlike Collins, Heller and Murkowski, Ted Cruz has said that he would vote no on the current Senate bill because it does not go far enough to dismantle Obamacare. He attempted to address a crowd in McAllen, Texas on Tuesday morning, but was drowned out by a group of protesters. In a follow-up interview, Cruz characterized the protesters as members of a small group of people on the left who right now are very angry. But a CNN poll last week said that only 32% of Americans thought that it should be passed as is or with minor changes.
How would you feel if you'd invited 50 people to a party and 45 of them RSVP'd no? 45 is the number of states that have refused requests by Chris Kobach, vice chair of President Trump's Election Reform Committee, for information on registered voters, including several confidential items like social security numbers and criminal records. The other 5 have not yet responded. 20 states are refusing to give Kobach any data, and 25 states are handing over only limited public information on voters, including Oregon, which is charging its usual $500 fee. Kansas, where Kobach is the Secretary of State, is among the 45 who refused, as are conservative states such as Louisiana, Arizona, and Indiana, home of Committee Chair Vice President Pence.
A federal appellate judge for Washington, D.C., has denied President Trump's attempt to roll back environmental protections concerning methane pollution from oil that was signed into law by President Obama. A representative for the Trump administration argued that Obama's plan had unfairly skipped over stakeholders' rights to object to potential damages caused to them by the Clean Air Act. But the court ruled in a 2-1 decision that industry groups had, quote, ample opportunity, unquote, to make their objections. Given Trump's aggressive attacks on environmental protections enacted by Obama, the matter is unlikely to end here.
In 1982, U.S. Fish and Wildlife first came up with guidelines for restoring gray wolves to the American Southwest and northern Mexico. Evidently not wanting to rush things, last Thursday they finally issued a recovery plan. Unfortunately for the wolves, the plan appears to weaken protections for the gray wolves from the original intention when the wolves were near extinction. The new plan sets a threshold of 320 wolves in the U.S. and 170 in Mexico in order for the wolves to be removed from the endangered species list. The plan released last week is only a draft of a final version expected this November. A 2012 draft of the recovery plan by Fish and Wildlife recommended a higher threshold spread over three populations rather than two, but it was dropped. The recovery zone affected by the plan is defined as below Interstate 40 in Arizona and New Mexico. Environmentalists and wolfophiles have been pushing to expand the recovery zone north of I-40, but in 2015, governors of neighboring states convinced the government to go with a Mexico-centric approach, citing concerns over safety and livestock poaching.
Over 100 people were shot during the 4th of July weekend in Chicago. According to the Chicago Tribune, about half of the shootings happened within a 12-hour span on Chicago's south and west sides. The youngest victim was a boy of 13. President Trump has said recently that he's considering sending in federal forces to Chicago.
U.S. police have shot and killed 492 people in the first 6 months of the year, about the same number in the same period during the last 2 years. Although armed white males are the category of people killed the most by police officers, black men, who account for only 6% of the population, make up about a quarter of the victims. 121, or nearly a quarter of the people shot and killed by police this year, were mentally ill. 27 of the victims were reported unarmed. As the number of police victims has stayed steady, so too have the number of officers indicted for fatal shooting. While thousands were killed by police between 2005 and 2015, only 54 officers have been charged, with most of them acquitted of all charges.
Now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Despite a bipartisan supermajority of the Illinois General Assembly voting to approve a state budget, billionaire Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner is still threatening to veto the state budget bill. The Illinois Federation of Teachers says, quote, "The governor's pledge to veto this strong bipartisan agreement and worsen the damage is deplorable. The damage already done by Rauner holding the Illinois budget hostage to his anti-union demands is severe." The IFT says five universities have reached junk bond status. The state owes more than $1 billion to K-12 schools and $15 billion to businesses who have provided goods and services expecting to be paid. Social services are shuttered. The Illinois Federation of Teachers urges the state to pass the assembly budget bill, and the union is urging Governor Rauner to sign it and stop his budget madness that's hurting Illinois. The Farm Labor Organizing Committee says North Carolina's Farm Bill S-615 is a shameful abuse of power that takes aim at our union in a blatant attempt to stop farm workers from achieving union agreements that include wage increases, job security, benefits, and improved working conditions, end quote. Flock says North Carolina politicians, who are also growers, are trying to use their legislative power to stop workers on the politicians' own farms from organizing for better wages and working conditions. Flock's Justin Flores says the ability to organize unions is the best chance farm workers have of improving their wages and working conditions.
We're talking about people doing backbreaking work for long hours, working 50, 60, 70 hours during the harvest season out in that hot sun each week. They certainly should have a wage high enough so that they don't need charity.
The union wants Governor Cooper to veto the farm bill. The bill attacks farm worker union power in several ways to undercut organizing efforts. It prevents farms from settling lawsuits with improved union contracts, and it prevents agricultural producers from directly deducting money for union dues. Flock Vice President Justin Flores says the North Carolina politicians are doing everything they can to stop the work
of Flock union organizers in the North Carolina fields. Healthcare activists in Oregon are not only fighting to defeat Trump Care, they have their eyes on a much bigger prize, universal single-payer health care for their state. Wes Brain hosts the Brain Labor Report on KSKQ in Ashland, Oregon. Brain is active in the Healthcare for All Oregon coalition of approximately 120 groups, including labor unions.
We're going to be voting in 2020. We're going to need 2020 vision. We're doing the education now for a statewide vote in 2020 to bring us single payer here in the state. It is so nice to be part of a campaign with vision and a strategy to make it happen in Oregon. In 2020, we're going to vote on, we're going to pass single payer health care in our state.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now, here's the lowdown with Jim Hightower.
You don't have to be in who's who to know what's what. For example, if a tiny group of Wall Street bankers, billionaires, and their political puppets are allowed to write the rules that govern our economy and elections, guess what? Only bankers, billionaires, and puppets will profit from those rules. That's exactly why our land of opportunity has become today's land of inequality. Corporate elites have bought their way into the policymaking backrooms of Washington, where they've rigged the rules to let them feast freely on our jobs, devour our country's wealth, and impoverish the middle class. There's good news, however. A growing grassroots coalition of churches, unions, civil rights groups, citizen activists, and many others is organizing and mobilizing us to crash through those closed doors, write our own rules, and reverse America's plunge into plutocracy. Called Take on Wall Street, the coalition's structural reforms include getting the corrupting cash of corporations and the super-rich out of our politics by repealing Citizens United and providing a public system for financing America's elections, stopping too-big-to-fail banks from subsidizing their high-risk speculative gambling with the deposits of us ordinary customers, making them choose to be a consumer bank or a casino, but not both. Instituting a tiny Robin Hood tax on Wall Street speculators to discourage their computerized gaming of the system, while also generating hundreds of billions of tax dollars to invest in America's real economy. Restoring low-cost, convenient postal banking in our post offices to serve millions of Americans who are now at the mercy of predatory payday lenders and check-cashing chains. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more about this campaign and its reform agenda to democratize America's financial system, go to www.takeonwallstreet.org. Takeonwallstreet.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Let's take a listen to the day, to the significance of this day in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day known as Bloody Thursday. The historic West Coast maritime strike had been raging since May 9th. Longshoremen refused to cede to the Industrial Association, determined to open the ports by force. The shipping bosses had rejected strikers' demands, including a union hiring hall and recognition of offshore unions. By July 3rd, picketers had been fighting for hours to stop trucks sent to move cargo under police protection as bosses attempted to open the ports. At 8 a.m. on this day, a line of strike-breaking trucks emerged. Thousands of strikers amassed in the warehouse district. The Battle of Rincon Hill had begun. The fighting continued throughout the afternoon in the center of the Embarcadero as strikers attempted to stop the scab freight cars. By the time it was over, longshoreman Howard Speary and strike supporter Nick Bordeaux lay dead from police bullets. 30 strikers had been shot and dozens more lay in the hospital, some critically wounded. The San Francisco Chronicle reported, "Blood ran red in the streets of San Francisco." In Workers on the Waterfront, Bruce Nelson notes, quote, "Bloody Thursday was an epic moment. Strikers conducted themselves with remarkable precision and imagination in the face of three successive assaults by police who were using their firearms freely and laying down a barrage of tear gas bombs." Donald McKenzie Brown, the businessman eyewitness, was overawed by the workers' insane courage in the face of bullets, gas, clubs, horse hooves, death, against fast patrol cars and the radio. They fought back with rocks and bolts till the street was a mass of debris. They were fighting desperately for something that seemed to be life for them.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News from the Boo at 5:45 and Kitchen Table Conversations at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather in Portland will be clear with a low of 61 and hot tomorrow with a high of 89. Tomorrow's high in Hood River will also be 89. Today in history, in 1950, the first U.S. soldier died in the Korean War. Quote of the day is from U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, who tweeted, "Spending my fourth in meetings all day. Hashtag thanks, North Korea."
And now, here's the latest update from 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is from the June 30th edition of Cultural Baggage.
Well, our guest for today has written a new book, Starting and Running a Marijuana Business. It's listed under the Idiot's Guide, As Easy as It Gets, and it's written by the owner, director of the Magnolia Wellness Center in Oakland/Berkeley, California, a frequent guest on the Cultural Baggage program, Debbie Goldsberry. Hello, Debbie.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Thank you for being with us. Debbie, I think you're one of those people who has the experience, the knowledge, and the ability to truly explain how in the world one goes about starting and running a marijuana business. Give us, if you will, a little summation. I'll have specific questions, but what's this book going to do for the reader?
Well, I've been involved in the cannabis industry all the way since I was in college. 1986, I first got involved. And pretty early on, I realized that most of the people who are providing marijuana and medical marijuana to people who are using it either for adult personal use or for their medical benefit, those people hadn't gone to business schools. They were busy in the trenches growing marijuana, really trying to stay out of sight, or driving marijuana around town in a clandestine manner. And other people at the same time were going to business school, in fact. And now we see kind of this confluence of both sides, people who are very experienced in business getting into the cannabis industry for the first time, and our own supporters who have been with us for 30 years, you know, sometimes less, but for a long time doing the work in the trenches, don't have all the skills that they need to compete yet in business. There's a big learning curve there. So my thought was, let's hit both markets. Let's educate the new entrepreneurs just entering in, to tell them about the cannabis movement, about the hard work we've done all this time, about 10,000 years of cannabis use that led to a prohibition of about 100 years, about people like Jack Carrere, author of The Emperor Wears No Clothes, who really introduced us all to hemp for the first time, about Dennis Perone, who started the modern medical marijuana movement. Let's give them some institutional education, make sure that people understand the laws, that this is still federally illegal, that city by city and county by county, you can either get in trouble or you can supply and grow and provide medical marijuana. And then, at the same time, let's take our own people and provide them with a simple path to running a good, solid business, how to incorporate, how to pick your board of directors, how to write your business plan, how to get your funding, and how to go into business. Maybe at the end, we'll have a socially conscious marijuana industry that helps in prohibition, where all of us are employed with single earner wages, raising our families, using marijuana if we want, and providing medical marijuana to people who need it.
Again, that was Debbie Goldsboro, author of a great new book, Starting and Running a Marijuana Business, Part 2 tomorrow, Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
A total solar eclipse will occur Monday morning, August 21st. It is the first total solar eclipse of the 21st century. A total solar eclipse is a point where the moon completely overlaps the sun, creating a period of darkness during the day. as the fifth largest moon in our solar system. Our moon is about one-third of the size of Earth. Our moon is about 4.6 billion years old, around the same age as Earth. The distance between the Earth and its moon averages about 238,900 miles. The rotation of the moon, the time it takes to spin once around on its own axis, takes the same amount of time as the moon takes to complete one orbit of the Earth, or about 27.3 days. This means the moon's rotation is synchronized in a way that causes the moon to show the same face to the Earth at all times. One hemisphere always faces us, while the other always faces away. The lunar far side, or the dark side, has been photographed only from spacecraft. Central Oregon expects record numbers of visitors to come to view the total solar eclipse, and local residents should be prepared. Getting ready for the August 21st total solar eclipse on Warm Springs Community Radio, 91.9 FM KWSO brings us more information.
A total solar eclipse will occur Monday morning, August 21st. It is a total solar eclipse that will be seen only in the United States, starting on the West Coast and ending on the East Coast. In 1954, there was a solar eclipse that started in the U.S. at Nebraska and traveled through South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, and in Wisconsin. Following within a few years, another solar eclipse passed through Massachusetts in 1959. Then in 1963, a solar eclipse had traveled across the northeast corner of the U.S., and one in 1970, crossing Florida and a good portion of the Atlantic seaboard. The final two eclipses that took place in the U.S. was in 1979 and 1991, one of which only crossed the Hawaiian Islands, and both were under cloudy skies, causing Hawaii's eclipse to be an unsuccessful viewing. The first total solar eclipse touching the continental United States since 1979 touches down on the Oregon coast between Lincoln City and Newport at 10:15 a.m. Before Oregon, the shadow of the moon, or the umbra, does not touch any other landmass or island. The solar eclipse will bring record numbers of visitors to Central Oregon. A lot of those people will be camping out at organized sites or in friends' yards. There will be gatherings, food, barbecues, and the need for everyone to practice safe food handling. To keep foods cold, you'll need a cold source. A block of ice keeps longer than ice cubes. You can freeze clean, empty milk cartons filled with water to make blocks of ice, or use frozen gel packs. Fill the cooler with cold or frozen foods. Pack foods in reverse order. First foods packed should be the last foods used. There is one exception. Pack raw meat or poultry below ready-to-eat foods to prevent raw meat or poultry juices from dripping on the other foods. And take foods in the smallest quantity needed, such as a small jar of mayonnaise. Getting ready for the August 21st total solar eclipse on Warm Springs Community Radio, 91.9 FM, KWSO.
There's a severe water shortage in Pakistan, and in the city of Karachi, there's little to no water flowing in pipelines. Americans are worried about their water, and the Trump administration is likely adding to that anxiety. The EPA's chief of staff bullied the top scientist on the agency's scientific review board to change her testimony to Congress. Southern California's ancient natives used plastic water bottles. Did the containers affect their health? A swimsuit competition lands a company in hot water.
The country of Pakistan may be running out of water. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
There's a severe and chronic water shortage in the entire country of Pakistan, a situation that is not expected to improve.
There's little to no water flowing in pipelines in Karachi, a city of at least 25 million, according to a member of parliament who spoke to the Express Tribune. He noted that a black market of tankers is selling water at exorbitant rates.
People in cities around the country have recently had to fill water jugs from public stations at 3 in the morning, according to the Washington Post.
Day-to-day life in Pakistan is made more difficult because there have been major cutbacks in electricity. One man said that in his house, his family can use only one light and one fan. Recently, temperatures in parts of the country reached over 127 degrees Fahrenheit.
People in agriculture are dependent on water flowing from India, with whom Pakistan has had three wars and much political strife. Tensions are higher now as India's Prime Minister Modi promotes Hindu nationalistic policies.
The crisis in Pakistan is dire as global warming reduces the amount amount of water that will flow from glaciers to rivers and as groundwater is being diminished due to overpumping.
The Pakistan Council of Research in Water Resources warns that the whole country could run out of water as early as 2025 if authorities do not act immediately.
A poll was released at the Aspen Ideas Festival revealing Americans are concerned on a nationwide basis about their drinking water.
The sampling showed that 2 out of 3 Americans believe their community is vulnerable to a water crisis, and 1/3 of those polled said they question whether the water in homes and schools is clean and safe.
The survey done by Nestle Waters comes in the wake of the crisis in Flint, Michigan, which no doubt has raised awareness about the importance of water.
And it comes at the same time that the Trump administration announced it was beginning the process to redefine what waters are protected under the Clean Water Act.
The Obama administration had crafted a rule which would have protected more than half of the country's rivers, streams, and wetlands from pollutants.
And now, presumably, the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers will craft a rule that is not nearly as inclusive and which will possibly create even more anxiety about the country's drinking water.
Speaking of the EPA, it was learned last week that a Trump political appointee in the agency tried to bully a top science advisor into altering her testimony to Congress.
Deborah Swackhammer, a retired professor at the University of Minnesota and leader of the EPA Science Advisory Panel, was set to testify about Trump's decision to dismiss most of the board's members.
The panel is not directly involved in the agency's studies, but gives critical feedback on how those studies are conducted, assuring that the science is good.
Swackhammer had already prepared her statements to Congress, commenting that the dismissals could lead to the perception that science was being politicized and marginalized within the EPA.
The day before she was set to testify, she received emails from Ryan Jackson, the chief of staff of the EPA under Scott Pruitt.
He told her that decisions had not been made about whether to dismiss the scientists. However, some of them had already received letters to that effect. The official even included talking points urging Swackhammer to rework the testimony she had already released.
Swackhammer told the New York Times that she was stunned by his emails and felt bullied. Democrats have asked the EPA's Inspector General to investigate the claims that the chief of staff pressured Swackhammer.
Since her testimony, the EPA has sent out dozens more notices that scientists' terms on the panel will not be renewed.
Scientists have known for some time that ancient native societies living in Southern California may have used something similar to what we use today. Plastic water bottles.
The indigenous peoples stored water in large woven bulbs coated with naturally occurring bitumen or tar, the same substance we use to make roads.
A new study shows that the making of these prehistoric water carriers may have led to a decline in the health of the native peoples.
The earliest evidence of the people who lived in the Channel Islands off the coast of Southern California dates them to about 13,000 years ago, but they began to decline about 5,000 years ago.
As reported in Wired, skeletal remains exhibit poor bone quality, smaller skulls, and bad teeth. Sabrina Schultz of the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., decided to study the issue, and she teamed up with others.
They made the ancient-style bottles and found that there were accumulations of various toxins in the water, but probably not enough to explain the skeletal problems. However, the smoke inhaled by those who made the bottles could explain their health problems, but further research is necessary.
And finally, applying for a summer internship can be competitive. You'll want to polish your resume, get good references, and of course, look your best for the swimsuit portion of the contest. Wait, what?
Yes, how you look in a bikini could score you a gig at a nuclear plant in the Czech Republic. That was the glowing idea at the Temelin Power Station, which posted pictures of 10 high school grads on its Facebook page with the promise that the woman who received the most likes would be crowned Miss Energy 2017 and awarded a two-week internship.
The public reacted, not surprisingly, with a total meltdown, calling the stunt sexist, unethical, primitive, and promoting beauty, not brains.
The page has since been pulled down, but according to CNN, each woman was wearing a bikini and a hard hat and had been photographed inside the station's cooling towers.
The parent company, CEZ, took to Facebook to say that all 10 women would be offered internships and an apology, stating that the purpose of the competition was to promote, quote, technical education.
But probably the people who learned the most were the folks who planned the event and landed the nuclear power plant in hot water.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn about water efficiency and resilience at awwa.org/sustainable.
And now, here's an Oregon News Service report on Oregon businesses fighting against climate change.
Oregon businesses are partnering to fight climate change with a new organization called the Oregon Business Alliance for Climate. The alliance supports pricing policies for carbon emissions in Oregon. Its 27 founding members span industries from restaurants and real estate companies to software and technology companies such as Uber and Airbnb. Head of the design firm Neil Kelly Company, Tom Kelly, chairs the alliance. He says fighting climate change is good for business.
The basic thing about business and being in business is certainty is important. And until we can really effectively address climate change, our economy in the state, our economy in the country, and the economy of the whole world is threatened.
The state has set goals for reducing carbon emissions. However, a report from the Oregon Global Warming Commission in February says the state won't reach its goals of reducing emissions below 75% of 1990 levels by 2050 on its current trajectory. Carbon pricing and cap-and-trade bills failed in the state legislature this year and were opposed by the state's two largest business organizations. However, members of the alliance believe they can help the state commit to reducing emissions going forward. Steve Clem is a vice president of construction company Skanska USA, a founding member of the alliance that also works with green building technologies. He says the state can become a leader on environmental issues and innovative solutions to the climate change challenge.
The idea that we come up with a mechanism that is a win-win for the environment, for business, is something that we could take to other places and demonstrate that it can be done.
Efforts to fight climate change fell largely to states and cities after President Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Jeremy Corbyn and his followers in the British Labour Party marched in London against austerity and the Tories' policy.
Supporters of the British Labour Party and its leader, Jeremy Corbyn, marched through London streets on Saturday from the BBC headquarters to the Parliament building at Westminster. The London-based Independent reports that tens of thousands joined the Not One More Day march against the Conservative Tory government and its austerity policies. They carried signs that read, "Tories out, no to Islamophobia, no to war, cut war, not welfare," and "Austerity is the new terror." Jeremy Corbyn addressed the crowd upon its arrival outside Parliament.
"What this election campaign, this anti-austerity movement, this current mood in British politics has done is unleashed the ideas and the imagination, unleashed that day-to-day conversation on every street corner, every cafe and every pub of how differently this country could be run. The Tories are in retreat. Austerity is in retreat. The economic arguments of austerity are in retreat. It's those of social justice, of unity, of people coming together to oppose racism and all those that would divide us that are the ones that are moving forward."
Some marchers held signs that said, "Austerity kills, justice for Grenfell," and a large contingent marched behind a banner reading, "Justice for Grenfell," meaning justice for the victims of the horrific Grenfell Tower public housing fire that killed mostly black and brown people, including refugees from the war-ravaged Middle East. The fire occurred because of cost-cutting on the cosmetic cladding applied to the outside of the building. which was not fire retardant. The government has since asked residents of other public housing towers with the same cladding to move out until the danger can be mitigated. Jeremy Corbyn spoke to the Grenfell tragedy at the rally.
And so, in the public inquiry that's now going to be called, I've written to the Prime Minister yesterday saying we want it quick and urgent in the case of Grenfell Tower, and we want a longer, much longer, more detailed inquiry into housing conditions and stock all over the country. Because it isn't just Grenfell Tower, there are issues over the whole of the country that have to be addressed, and we will make sure those issues are addressed. So surely, if ever there was a wake-up call for what happens in modern Britain, it's got to be that disaster of Grenfell Tower and the loss of life that went with it.
Some believe that Conservative Party leader Theresa May's minority government could fall before the end of the year, despite her deal with the Democratic Unionist Party, whose main issue is keeping Northern Ireland within the UK and thereby preventing the reunification of Ireland. Whether an election is held this year or later, Jeremy Corbyn promised to throw himself into the next campaign.
So we've identified 73 constituencies in England, Wales and Scotland that we can win. And you know what? I'm going to go to every single one of them. We're going to take the campaign to the Tories because we are utterly determined that the message will get out there, the message of hope.
And that was Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking at a pro-Labour, anti-Tory, anti-austerity march held in London on Saturday. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
China's only Nobel laureate, Liu Xiaobo, has been released from prison after an 11-year sentence for medical leave. He's issued to have doctors from the U.S. and Germany to treat him. Xiaobo was charged with inciting subversion of state power in 2008 after contributing to the pro-democracy Tiananmen Square demonstrations in 1989. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his activism in 2010, and he's the only Nobel laureate serving a prison sentence.
The administrative capital of the European Union in Brussels, Belgium, will urge other countries in the EU to accept migrants coming from Northern Africa to relieve some of the pressure from Italy, who sends its coast guard to pick up migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea. European Union heads want all members to help resettle 37,000 vulnerable people from five North African countries by the end of 2018. The objective came from an Amnesty International report showing ineffective EU policies, the rising migrant death toll, and the abuses refugees face that cause them to migrate. It's estimated that 85,000 migrated northbound through the Mediterranean in the first half of 2017, and just over 2,000 people died in that process.
An Afghani robot will be competing in Washington, D.C.'s first global challenge later this month, but the six girls who created it won't be there because some were denied visas. Afghanistan is not on the list of six countries banned by the Trump travel ban, as approved by the Supreme Court. Teams from Iran and Sudan, as well as a de facto Syrian team, three countries included in the travel ban, were issued visas. Asked yesterday why the girls were banned, a U.S. State Department spokesperson cited regulations prohibiting the agency from discussing individual visa cases.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Kyle Qureshi. Our engineer tonight is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers welcomes activist and poet Judith Arcana in her new book, Announcements from the Planetarium. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, featuring interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Yes, indeed, it is very, very nearly 5:45 on a Wednesday, which means it is time for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of items of interest here at the station and in the greater listening community. We are joined tonight, as we often are, by station manager Gil Cardone. Hello, Gil.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
And tonight we are also joined for the first time ever by Rose Flores Medlock, who is a member of the KBOO Board of Directors. Hello, Rose.
Hello.
Welcome to News from the Boo. Excellent to have you here. So, Aaron, why don't you start?
All right. Well, Rose, why don't you tell us a little bit about what brought you to KBOO and how long and in what capacities you've been involved with the KBOO community?
Sure. So I was a KBOO supporter long before becoming a board member last September. So it's been almost a year now. And, you know, at the time I was, of course, informed about current events, politics and so forth. But I became sort of increasingly alarmed as the election progressed and realized that I just needed to devote more of my time to activism and really being part of a solution. So KBOO has definitely been a piece of that effort for me.
And you a Portland native, Rose?
I am not.
Oh, where are you from?
I'm from the Los Angeles area, from Pasadena, California.
Ah, cool. Yeah. Southern Cal.
Yep.
All are welcome here. You got a sheepish look when he asked you that.
Well, yeah, actually, with recent events, I suppose, yeah, you would feel a little hesitant to admit California-ism nowadays.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where you do kind of run into people who, you know, are not always very nice or kind to find out that you're not a native Oregonian, but you know, takes all kinds. And I grew up on Pacifica Radio listening to KPFK, and you know, when I moved here in, I guess, 2009, you know, it was a time to look for that kind of replacement, and KBOO totally stepped up.
Yeah, so what was it about KBOO in particular, or really the